There's a lot that could impress you about the all-new Honda Prologue EV. True, it's got class-leading passenger space and clean, thoughtful design and intuitive technology. But what really sets the Prologue apart from the competition is that it's more than an EV. It's a Honda. Honda, the power of dreams. Visit Honda.com/Prologue to learn more.
Hello, friends. This is Craig Nybo. I've just launched a Kickstarter with a single backer level, so you can get your hands on my new hardback illustrated book, Tesla v. Cthulhu, A Bedtime Story. You can scan a QR code on the title page of the book or listen along audio, performed by me, with original music and plenty of sound effects to amp up your reading experience. You only have until the end of January to reserve your copy of this extremely limited hardback edition of the book. Click on the link in this episode's description for more information. And here are the details.
Greetings, boys and girls. Are you ready for tonight's bedtime story? I've chosen an excellent selection from the annals of volumes that guarantees to keep that monster under your bed and that boogeyman in your closet. Tonight, I give you Tesla v. Cthulhu, the story of three witches who kidnap Nikola Tesla from his laboratory in Colorado Springs. They have nothing but nefarious plans for him as they spirit the genius away to a secret location in the woods. They plan to incite the most powerful spell in their ancient book, the Necronomicon. You see, their spell demands the sacrifice of a clever man, and there's none more clever than Nikola Tesla to summon Cthulhu, a great old one. Jerusha and her sisters want Cthulhu to overthrow the world and turn humans into slaves. They hope Cthulhu will give them lofty stations as queens in his court, but that remains to be seen. The big question, will Fritz Lowenstein, Tesla's assistant, and his friends make it in time to save Nikola Tesla from certain death and from a world of subjugation under one of the darkest entities the universe has ever seen? Let's find out, shall we? Nikola Tesla lived in his laboratory on Nob Hill outside of Colorado Springs, where he and his assistant, Fritz Lowenstein, produced...
Get the extremely limited edition, fully illustrated hardback book Tesla v. Cthulhu, A Bedtime Story. 30 pages and 18 high-quality illustrations. But that's not all. You can follow along as Craig Nybo, author, performs the story, amped up with exciting sound effects and original music. Just scan the QR code on the title page and read along. You will know when it is time to turn the page when you hear the insane occultist witch scream in terror like this. A single backer level makes your decision easy. Get the book and access to the follow-along audio for only $44.99. Pick up your copy of Tesla v. Cthulhu, A Bedtime Story by backing this Kickstarter Make 100 project today. Pick up a copy of Trash War, a family card game from Quirky Engine Entertainment at Amazon.com today.
Mostly, we scavenged what we needed. Galvanized steel pipes for spear handles, stone-sharpened rake tines for close combat. We became good at turning plowshares into swords. And oh, how we fought. Like demons we fought. We fought for honor, for glory, for comfort and space. Mostly we fought because there was fighting to be done. And when there's fighting to be done, if you ain't mad enough to pick up the sword and answer the call, well then, you ain't mad at all. And let's slip the junkyard dogs of war.
Pick up a copy of Trash War, a family card game from Quirky Engine Entertainment at Amazon.com today.
the Terrifying Lies podcast with music and stories by Craig Nybo.
Greetings, friends. Welcome to episode 2 of season 2 of the Terrifying Lies podcast. Today, I offer you part 2 of the weird Western tale, Dead Pact Oblivion. If you haven't heard part 1, I encourage you to go back an episode and listen to catch up on the story before you proceed. With no more delay, let's get into it. I take you back to the town of Bannock, a lost Western village in a lost world overrun by demonic forces. At the end of the story, I give you a new song composed specifically for this episode. The song is called Pay the Devil. To keep you in the mood of the story, I will roll straight from the narrative into the song with no interruption. Dead Pact Oblivion, Part 2 of 3, written and performed by Craig Nybo. Liv and Galen reined in their horses at the mouth of a cave that stared down like a gigantic vacuous eye on Bannock from a rise to the east of town. From their high vantage point, Galen took in the layout. The town had bloomed from an abundant aquifer that found its origin in a series of trickling rivers, sourced from underneath a network of slot canyons and scorched hardpan. Judging by the boys who jumped them back at Uncle Jared's place, it seemed to Galen that the people of Bannock weren't much interested in groundwater these days. They thirsted for something else. And if the frontiersman's poison had set its roots into the community, Galen guessed that the townsfolk were plenty hungry. Without so much as a handful of words expressed between them, Galen and Liv worked to set up camp. Liv gathered enough kindling and dried Joshua wood to start an economic fire. Galen produced a pot and filled it halfway up with water from his skin. He poured 2 fist-sized measures of beans into the water and spit at the pot above the flames with a wire apparatus he'd made several years ago. They didn't have time to soak the beans. They'd have to be content with the slug-like texture of improperly prepared legumes. Galen broke a stick from one of the Joshua corpses and handed it to Liv. "Draw Bannock," he said, pointing at the ground. Liv glanced down the rise at the little town, the place where she'd lived her whole life, the place that she'd watched go rotten within just a few short weeks. She used the stick to trace a series of lines in the dirt. She drew a few boxes to mark buildings. "Bank," she said, pointing at one of them. "Stables," she said, pointing at another. "Tavern and inn," she pointed again. "Smithy and mercantile. Few people live in town, but most settled out on the range. Ain't much there. Bannock's not like the big cities I've seen in the national paper when it comes in." "Where's the church?" Galen asked. Liv smirked, shook her head. "Temple one." She drew a box at the end of what she called Main Street. She marked the box with a cross.
"Who's the pastor?" Galen asked.
"Name's Jeffrey Myers," Liv said, and bit her bottom lip. "He and his family, the only ones left who's clean. Rest has all turned the ways of the devil, like the McKinnish boys back at my uncle's place."
"If he and his kin are the only ones who haven't turned, they ain't clean. Not in God's eyes and not in mine."
Galen sat down cross-legged on the ground. He drew out the .30 caliber from his holster. He unfolded a small toolkit taken from one of his saddlebags. He unrolled a thick steer leather from the kit, revealing a collection of odd implements, a metal corkscrew-looking tool, and full of vials tucked into individual pouches, a sheathed knife with a holy symbol carved into its hard bone handle. He picked up the corkscrew and, using a set of calipers, fastened it to the handle of the .30 caliber. He connected a small crank to the top of the mechanism and began to spin the corkscrew. Bit by bit, he augured a hole, about a half inch in diameter, into the wood of the .30 caliber's handle.
"What are you doing?"
Liv asked.
"You were right back there," Galen said. "This weapon's not good against them. I shoot with these P rounds and they'll get up and keep coming. I'm fixing the weapon, giving it God power."
Liv stirred the beans with a long wooden spoon.
"Can you describe the drifter?"
Galen asked, keeping his attention on his work. Liv continued stirring.
"Tall,"
she said. "Don't remember much about him, except how he walked. Kind of smooth, like he was moving through water, I suppose."
"Did you see his face?"
Liv stopped stirring. She tilted her head to one side and pursed her lips.
"Yeah, I saw his face."
She used the end of the spoon's handle to scratch her temple.
"Saw his face plenty. Only thing is, can't remember what it looked like."
Galen tightened his scowl.
"That's him," he said.
"Who is he?"
Liv asked.
"He don't have a name. Some call him the Frontiersman. He ain't alone. There are others."
"Why'd he bring his evil to Bannock? We don't have nothing to do with nobody."
"Don't much matter, I suppose," Galen said. "Frontiersman, he and his lot, preparing the world for something called the Dry Harvest. It's the nearest I can reckon."
"What is the Dry Harvest?"
Liv asked. Galen opened his saddlebag, reached inside, and fished until he found something. He drew out a book and flipped through its dog-eared pages toward the end, handed it to Liv.
"Read the marked verses."
"What is this, Bible?"
"Not the Bible, something else,"
Galen said.
"What else?"
Liv asked.
"Something else. Read."
Liv read aloud.
"Three shall come and make 20. 20 shall go forth and make ready the land for the dry harvest. And the 20 shall convert man and beast and the plants of the field. The whole world shall become dry unto a brittle leaf. And then shall the dry harvest come onto the land like a season. And all that are imperfect in the eye of the forsaken one, Uzaliel, shall become purer in his eyes. And God shall turn his head for the season of the dry harvest, for it shall be a time of cleansing, a time when man shall once again turn his heart unto God."
Liz closed the book and pushed it away.
"What kind of God is this?"
Galen licked the tip of his finger and touched his forehead and heart in turn.
"The only true God."
"Why would he turn his head away from us?"
"You read the words."
"Why would he abandon us?"
"You read the words."
Galen blew a claw of the wood shavings away from the hole he'd augured out of the .30 caliber's grip and disconnected the corkscrew mechanism. He drew one of the glass vials from its pouch in his steer-hide tool case and slid it into the hole. He plucked the cork from the little vial's throat. He picked up the sheath knife from his kit and unscrewed the pommel, revealing a watertight vessel in the knife's handle. He opened the knife over the little glass vial in the gun's handle. A few drops of fluid leaked from the knife handle into the vial.
"Damn," he said. "Not enough."
He screwed the pommel back onto the knife's handle and slid the blade out of its sheath. Half a dozen runes shone on the blade. Galen flipped the gun over and began carving symbols in the opposite grip, referencing the runes on the knife's blade as he worked. One by one, he carved 6 symbols into the wooden handle. Liv strained the beans and lumped off 2 servings onto a pair of tin plates Galen had provided. She put one in front of Galen and began eating off from the other, scooping beans up with her fingers and putting them into her mouth as she watched Galen finish his work on the revolver.
"You don't look like no holy man,"
Liv said as Galen finally put the gun aside and started in on his meal.
"There ain't no such thing as holy men no more,"
he said. They ate in silence as the night brought on its darkness and cool. Galen did what he could to make Liv comfortable by providing her a blanket from his bedroll. He sat up a little later, sharing his attention between the town and the girl as she drifted off to sleep. As the stars looked down on Galen's little camp, he kept his eyes on Bannock, a quiet collection of buildings huddled together like tombstones. As he sat there on the rise, thinking about what he would have to do in the morning, he couldn't help but reflect on better times. Times before the frontiersman had brought his quorum to wreak their rapid and permanent change on the world. He thought about Liv's question. What kind of god is this? Galen had spent more time than he would ever admit thinking about that question. Sometimes that question even threatened to quash his hope altogether. But somehow he found the might to move forward in the face of so much loss. The frontiersman wasn't alone. He had the 3 and the 20. But Galen wasn't alone neither. There were others like him. He'd seen them here and there, fighting against the frontiersmen, doing what they could. And yet, they all knew that stopping the dry harvest would be like moving a mountain or halting a mighty river. But even in the face of utter defeat, something drove men to fight. Galen suspected that the others like him, the men and women who chose to read the words and stand, also thought about Liv's question from time to time. But then, again and again, they ran into the fight.
The Terrifying Lies podcast will return after this short commercial break.
There's a lot that could impress you about the all-new Honda Prologue EV. True, it's got class-leading passenger space and clean, thoughtful design and intuitive technology. But what really sets the Prologue apart from the competition is that it's more than an EV. It's a Honda. Honda, the power of dreams. Visit Honda.com/Prologue to learn more.
With Kizik Hands Free Shoes, motion sounds something like this. Kizik helps you experience the magic of motion. With over 200 patents and easy on, easy off technology, you'll never have to touch your shoes again. There are hundreds of styles and colors, plus a squish like nothing you've ever felt. For a limited time, get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
Welcome back to the Terrifying Lies podcast.
An overcast sky painted gloom across Bannock. Shadowless buildings stood huddled together against ages of weather, like feeble bastions standing above the poison that visited them and left its stain. Liv and Galen rode along Main Street, their horses clopping on the hard-packed earth in syncopated rhythm. The raised wooden walks that fronted banks of buildings on both sides of the street remained, for the most part, empty. But Galen noticed drapes parting in upper windows and blinds lifting to allow curious peeks out into the street. A few of Bannock's citizens dressed the scene, standing like stocks at storefronts, sitting on benches, hats pushed back on heads. Galen had seen such sentries before. They're like actors, playing out their parts on a stage, but this was no stage. A few more people came out onto the canting boardwalks and settled on the stoops. They kept their eyes on Liv and Galen, fixed and unblinking. Galen noticed their pale skin, just like the McKinnish boys back at Liv's uncle's place. Granted, the McKinnish boys had reached an advanced stage of the affliction, but the people of Bannock had the frontiersman's madness. Of that, Galen was sure.
And there was one other thing of which Galen was sure. The inflicted could not be healed. As Galen and Liv neared the church, a handful of the afflicted stepped off the boardwalks and moved into the street. Their eyes locked on the cowboy and the girl. They moved with that unsure gait Galen had learned to recognize, like their joints were becoming rusty, like they were not moving so much as being moved. The closer the two of them got to the church, the more the afflicted appeared, coming out of doors, moving into the light, around corners. Galen pulled up his mount and turned to face them. They stood in staggered patterns all the way up Main Street, stopped, standing, staring.
"What do they want?"
Liv asked, pulling her mount up next to Galen.
"They're protecting the church. They always do."
"We can leave. Right on."
"You are welcome to go," Galen said. "But my place is here."
"Hell,"
Liv said.
"They're my family. They're my friends. This town is everything I have ever known. If there's any way to save them, I'm staying."
"There's only one way to save them," Galen said.
"How?"
"Get down off your horse."
Galen and Liv dismounted. Galen, keeping his eyes on the afflicted, took Liv's lead. He tethered the horses together with a generous length of rope.
"If they take our horses, we got nothing," he said.
Galen swatted his Mustang and trotted away, leading the Belgian along in tow.
"Why'd you do that?"
Liv asked.
"Horses don't like the afflicted none. They'll throw us. We gotta trust our grounding."
Galen drew his .30 caliber, but knew that with an empty vial and its grip, the weapon would be useless. He moved toward the church. Liv followed. As the two of them neared the stoop, the afflicted closed in, moving with more deliberation by the second. Just as Galen and Liv mounted the stoop, the afflicted attacked. Galen swore under his breath and drew the knife he'd taken from his toolkit.
"You asked how we can save him,"
Galen said. Liv looked up at him, readying her shotgun. Galen moved off the stoop and met the first of the afflicted, an aged man with a husk of crinkly hair jutting from beneath an ancient hat. The man opened his mouth and moaned out something foul. He raised his hand and leaned toward Galen. Someone had carved the bent cross in the man's palm. Galen whipped his knife across the man's hand, slicing off two fingers. The man moaned in pain. Galen plunged the blade into the man's heart. He dropped like a sack. Liv fired, felling a woman who wore a blue dress and a bonnet. Galen thought he heard Liv weeping as she pumped the gun and fired again.
"To the church," Galen shouted. "Get inside now."
Liv backed away, keeping her gun trained on her neighbors. First there were five, and then there were 20. They came in stuttering clumps. Galen swept his knife across him. The weapon warmed in his hand as he fought. The runes had come to life, empowering the knife with unworldly might. Two of the inflicted got around Galen's flank. Galen fought with a series of spins and kicks. He managed to slice one of them with a glancing slash. Others closed in from the street, pushing up the steps and reaching. From the church's front entrance, Liv aimed at the two who'd gotten hold of Galen, but she couldn't shoot without risk of hitting him. She slid her aim back and forth, tracking him, waiting for an opportunity to fire. The two forced Galen to bend at his waist. One of them wrapped his arms around Galen's head and craned it back and forth in a madman struggle to break his neck. Galen fumbled for his .30 caliber. After a couple of failed gropes, he drew it free. He didn't want to waste bullets with an unsanctified weapon, but he didn't have much choice. He put the gun against the man's abdomen and fired. The man's guts suppressed the report. He stumbled backward, holding his wounded belly, shrieking in pain. Galen spun away. He aimed at the second man and fired, missing with his first shot. The man jumped at him,
Galen did his best to stay calm, to ignore the others who were mounting the stoop. He shot the man in the forehead. The man curled to the ground and lay still for a moment. Galen knew the man was dead, but eventually he would just lie down and let the vultures take him. But the frontiersman's power had given the afflicted man a kind of extended afterlife. If Galen couldn't hit him with a sanctified weapon, such as his knife, they'd just keep coming for perhaps an hour before finally consenting to natural death. "Inside!" Galen shouted, backing away from the mob. He moved to the door and tried the latch. It was locked. "Damn!" he said. He wasted 5 more rounds on the locking mechanism before the church door opened. Liv fired at the same woman she'd shot in the gut just a few moments ago. Shot in the shoulder, the woman spun off to the side and collapsed. Face down on the stoop, she began to push herself back up. Galen pulled the door open and shoved Liv inside. She lost her balance and collapsed to the hard floor. Galen followed her into the dim and slammed the church door shut. With the locking mechanism destroyed, Galen searched the room for something he could use. He settled on one of the back pews, long pine bench. He ran to the end of the pew and drug it across the floor. He pushed the pew's end up against the door and backed away. The afflicted tried the church entrance, but the pew held. They pommeled the door, screaming out their otherworldly hisses and animalistic cries, probably bloodying their fists on the hard wood. Galen helped Liv to her feet.
"What did he do to my friends?"
she asked.
"They're not your friends anymore. They serve chaos."
Someone darted from a hiding place halfway up the row of pews. Galen spun around and drew his pistol, but held his fire.
"Stop! Or I'll put a hole in your head," he shouted.
The kid, no older than 14, skidded to a halt and raised his hands. The boy stood in the corner of the rectory, framed by an enormous crucifix, fixed on the wall behind him. Someone had sawed off the bottom of the cross and remounted it at a slanted angle, creating the bent cross Galen had seen so many times, carved into the palms of the afflicted.
"Turn around slowly and let me see your palms," Galen said.
The boy rotated and revealed the pink undersides of his hands. He hadn't been marked. Galen stalked over to the boy and grabbed him by the collar. He whisked the boy around and grabbed a hank of his red hair. The boy yelped. Galen drew his rune-inscribed knife and put it into the boy's throat.
"Priest, I know you're here. I got your boy."
The boy whimpered.
"Your name,"
Galen said, yanking the boy's red hair.
"Mike, my name's Mike,"
the boy said through his blubbering.
"Jeffrey Myers," Galen shouted. "I have little Mike here. I have a notion that you know what I'm capable of."
A door at one side of the raised chancel at the front of the church opened.
A man peeked from the dim into the nave area. He spotted Galen and Mike. The man raised his hands and walked out onto the platform.
Galen pulled Mike close and refreshed his grip on the rune-inscribed knife. He wrestled the waterskin from his shoulder and tossed it onto the chancel. At Myers' feet, Myers looked down at the skin and back up at Galen, his eyebrows netted.
"You're a coward,"
Galen said. The afflicted hadn't stopped pounding on the door. He had to shout above the thumping and braying.
"We should go,"
Liv said from somewhere behind Galen. "Release the child," Myers said, nodding toward Mike.
"You don't care about the boy,"
Galen said. Mike struggled to keep from bawling. He sniffled and blinked out, half tears.
"He's my son,"
Myers said. Galen flipped the knife in his hand and conked Mike in the temple with the handle. Mike swooned. Galen let the boy drop and drew his revolver. He aimed at Myers.
"None of this is necessary,"
Myers said, gesturing toward the unconscious boy lying on the ground.
"I can save you."
"You can't save me,"
and you can't save yourself. Show me the mark. What?
Myers said.
Your hand. Raise it.
Myers slowly raised his hand, revealed his palm. The double lightning bolt of the Elder Futhark Suwilo rune scarred his skin. Galen cringed at the symbol. Jeffrey Myers, like the others he'd encountered, was supposed to be the father of his people, their protector and spiritual leader. But he'd sold out his authority for power and positioning in the Quorum. And he would spoil the boy, Mike, in the bargain. Take what's left of your god power, bless the water. What? Myers asked, his shoulders raised in a slight shrug. The water at your feet, bless it. Galen aimed at the boy, crumpled on the floor, or I will kill your son. You bring such evil into my church, Myers said, his mouth twisting into a sneer.
There is no evil,
Galen said,
only life, death, dominance, and submission.
Galen aimed at Myers and fired his last round. He deliberately missed the priest, but only by a few inches. The bullet thunked into the curve of the apse at the back of the chancel. Myers flinched. He wanted to bolt. Galen couldn't let the man run. He needed the water.
Bless the water, now,
Galen said. Myers hesitated for a moment, then bent down and snatched up the water skin. He opened the lid and turned his eyes upward. At gunpoint, he uttered a short prayer in Latin, then screwed the lid back onto the skin. Galen moved through the nave, keeping his gun on Myers' head. Myers backed away a couple of steps as Galen mounted the chancel. He snatched the water skin from Myers and holstered his weapon. Myers began to sigh. Galen cut it off by grabbing the priest's collar and flinging him toward the chancel steps. Myers struggled to regain his footing, but he went down the stairs in a graceless tumble. He fell hard, sprawling out on the hardwood floor, bumping his head on the front pew. Before Myers could stand up, Galen was on him, speed loading his pistol as he moved.
You sold them out,
Galen said.
What was their price? Money?
Galen kicked Myers in the side. Myers yelped and flipped to his back.
Power?
Galen kicked him again.
Oh. Maybe a position in a Quorum?
Galen kicked him again. Myers flipped onto his hands and knees and crawled up the center aisle. Galen finished loading his pistol. Before Myers made it halfway to the door, Galen moved in, barrel of the pistol behind the priest's ear. Myers stopped, closed his eyes, and uttered a sobbing prayer.
Who you praying to? If you ain't noticed, God ain't listening anymore, especially to the likes of you.
Myers opened his eyes and looked up at Galen.
Have mercy, brother.
I ain't your brother.
Galen fired, dropping Myers. Liv sat down on one of the long pews. She looked away. Galen walked the aisle and sat next to her. He rested the water skin in his lap. He laid his pistol down and tugged the little cork from the vial he'd seated into the gun's grip. He opened the water skin and filled the vial with blessed liquid. Liv slid over next to him. She cowered into him, pushing her chin into his shoulder. Galen unscrewed the pommel of his knife and filled the handle with more of the blessed water. He screwed the pommel back down, picked up Liv's shotgun. He used the rune engraved knife to carve a half dozen runes into the stock. He put the shotgun down in his lap and doused his hands with water from the skin. He massaged the water into the wood of the stock. He soused it over the barrel and flicked some on the trigger. He laid the three weapons on the pew and said a brief prayer, something in a language Liv didn't understand. Mike began to come around, still lying on the floor where Galen had knocked him cold.
What will you do with Mikey?
Liv asked. Galen looked at the boy, cocked his head to one side and smirked.
Boy's been spoiled. He's seen things that his father's done.
Will you kill him?
He hasn't taken the mark,
Galen said.
He's on his own.
The entrance to the church clattered open. The afflicted came, their eyes gaping as they left the outdoor light. Galen poured a bead of water from the skin onto his trigger finger. He said a short phrase in the same foreign language he'd used to supplicate over the weapons. He touched his forehead and his heart with his wet finger. He picked up his pistol in one hand and his knife in the other and turned to meet the onslaught. This has been Dead Pact Oblivion, Part 2 of 3, and Pay the Devil, written, composed, and performed by Craig Nybo. Thanks for joining me for this episode of the Terrifying Lies podcast. If I haven't said so, I need to express my gratefulness to you for listening in every first and third Friday at high noon. It really does mean a lot. If you like the podcast, I encourage you to leave a positive review on iTunes, Audible, Spotify, Amazon Music, Podcast Addict, or wherever you choose to listen in. Thank you so much for joining me. I consider you all my friends. Don't forget to come back for part 3, the conclusion of Dead Pact Oblivion. Until then, I wish you the darkest of dreams. Sweet nightmares.
This has been the Terrifying Lies Podcast. Please come again. You're welcome here.